Welcome to another episode of We Are EMS Educators, a podcast. I'm Dan Limmer with co-host Chuck Elias, and we are really happy to be talking to Heather Davis. Heather Davis, you may know as the former program director at the UCLA Paramedic Program, frequent conference speaker. Heather, you helped me out with research and you're all-around good person. Now the director of assessment for the School of Medicine at UCLA. So it's awesome to have here, especially for a topic like this. I'll just announce the topic and we'll just get into it. But the concept of creating a positive experience for students, having them feel like they belong, creating an environment for them. I think that there's a lot of us that have been around a long time would say, boy, there's times that we eat our young in EMS. And sadly, it seems to start in the classroom. So welcome, Heather. Let's get right into it.
Great. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. I appreciate the invitation. Yeah, this is a topic that I think is important. I agree with you. There's so many healthcare professions that are sort of, like you said, mean to our young, or it has been sort of uphill, both in the snow, barefoot, both directions. And we've felt like everybody else has to do it too. I went through that process, so it has to be just as hard as I had it. And yet we're experiencing a time when it's really tough to staff our rigs and meet our schedules and serve our communities. And we might need to rethink that. And so I'm really interested and have been for the, you know, last, I don't know, decade in creating an environment in which people understand that we want you here and we want you to succeed and you can do it. We will help. That's sort of one of my mottos. And I think if you don't intentionally include, you will accidentally exclude. And so thinking about behaviors and things that you can do in the classroom as an educator, whether you're a skills instructor, a lead educator, a program director, what role you have, how you can help people feel like they belong, they can do it, and that they can be successful in this field of EMS, whether they're baby first responder just getting started and excited, or whether they're going to paramedic school and beyond.
You talked about we want them to feel included and we'll help them along. How do you get that point across to the student, but then also not have them say, well, you're going to do everything for me and almost expect everything to be sort of spoon-fed to them or given to them? Because I agree with that, but those are some things that I think sometimes the students turn around and say, well, you said you're going to help me, and they don't do their part.
Yeah, so setting expectations is important. And one of the elements of, helping people develop efficacy or the sense of efficacy compared to, you know, confidence is very task specific. And so the specific task of I can be successful in an EMS program is helping people understand that you believe they can be successful and have setting high expectations for themselves. And so the image I have in my head is of kind of setting the bar high and repeated messages that they can get over the bar. Like, we don't lower the bar so that people will trip over it. The bar stays the same, but we will help you get over it. And it is important that they hear from you that you believe they can do it, and that there will be multiple ways to demonstrate competency. And so that becomes important too when we think about assessment and testing, and we understand that, you know, people have different ways in which they demonstrate their excellence. I used to have really strong beliefs about, in fact, I was visiting the other day, just 2 days ago, about one of our graduates who's now applying to medical school, and we have a number of those. And we were talking about the rigor of a medical school. And I said, you know, the way that you had 8 hours of material, and then the next day there was a quiz, 8 hours of material, the next day there's a quiz. I said, I don't apologize for that cadence and pace, because you will now be well equipped for what you're moving into. But something did change along the 20 years that I spent leading a paramedic program. And it used to be, if you had failed a certain number of quizzes, then you would be exited from the program. And I did change that along the way, that philosophy of, if you can't pass the daily quizzes, then you're not eligible to sit for the major exams, because what we learned after time is that people get better at taking quizzes. They need practice at learning how to take multiple choice exams. And this is an example of meeting people where they are and helping them develop the skills that they will need to be successful instead of expecting them to arrive with everything that they need. So this can be an example of, you can do it, we will help. You arrived here, how you are, who you are, with whatever competencies you had from your life. And, you know, in the civil service, I mean, some of those might be reading at the fifth grade reading level, you know, and that's how they arrive. And some of them might have a master's degree. That's who you have sitting in class, right? Is a variety of people with different competencies and different backgrounds and whatever exposures they had. They come from different circumstances. And our goal is, you know, 42 in and 42 out. Every one of those learners who arrived can be successful, but not on their own. It takes a village and it takes responsibility to help every one of them get there. So your question was, how do we make sure that they own that? And it's not my responsibility, but our responsibility to get there. I think some of that messaging early about, you can do it, but we will help you. And then another is, take advantage of all of the things that we have here to offer you, all of the services. And oftentimes we have learners who will be like, no, no, I don't want to bother you. I know you're busy. I don't want to bother you. I'll figure it out. And it's like, first of all, that's my job. I want to help you. You're not bothering me. And I say these things at an orientation that happens well before the first day of class, with their families there, moms, wives, dads, whoever their support network is. And we encourage them to bring everyone who's going to support you through this process so that those people hear the message. Don't let anybody circle the drain. If somebody's struggling, ask them, hey, have you been to office hours? Are you going to tutoring? Reach a hand. And sometimes they need to hear from those other people on their support network. Like, hey, doctor, I heard Dr. Davis offer this. I remember that there's this available. Are you doing that? Like, let's not start with the negative self-talk. Let's make sure we reach back and pull people along with us.
There are probably stories, good and bad, and we talked a little bit as we were warming up about some of those. And two of the points that struck me is that sometimes students go through things that we don't realize they keep inside, and they're having difficult situations. And it almost sounds like, and I don't want to get too, too corny or existential here, but it's like we're almost creating a nest that people can come back to. And don't we really want that when people go through EMT? To come back for our AEMT or a paramedic program, that we're creating something. So could you share some of those, anything that you can think of about some of the things your students have been through and how the environment that you created helped it resolve?
Yeah, the one of the stories that I was sharing with you is a learner who was a class leader, class president, and that's an elected position. So that demonstrates that his peers saw him with leadership potential. He also was high ranking, may have been the valedictorian in his class, but I remember that he was high ranking and was already a firefighter, meaning he was sponsored from his department, paid to be there. And so when we think about transition to field internship, you expect that transition might be a little bit easier because some of the nuances and culture of transitioning into the fire service would be some of those expectations he would already understand. Things about, where do you park? Where do you sit? What time do you need to get there? Some of that culture he would already understand from being a badged member. And yet I learned, I had actually already moved to my new position, but I had learned that he was struggling. And so for the folks that were still there, I sort of said, I am very surprised. And they said, oh yeah, he's going to get exited. He's fallen apart. And I was like, this is not normal. This is a problem. Somebody needs to find out to talk to him and what is going on. And so when somebody reached out to him, I said, just ask an open-ended question. Tell me about what's happening there. Tell me about the environment. Tell me about the people you're working with. And because learners are, I think, there is a power differential, right, for learners and instructors, learners and preceptors. And my experience has been, they really just want to please you and do whatever it takes to get on, you know, get the license and move on. And they are pretty good at picking up the good things and leaving the bad, and will endure maybe what is not so awesome, and, you know, leave the rest and move on. But so anyway, when they interviewed this person or visited with this person, we've learned that there was no space for him. They had not made space for him at the station to a place for him to sleep, a place for him to store his belongings, a place for him to study. And he was, they had set up a cot, or said, you can set up a cot in the service porch where the search and rescue dog was being housed. So there's a dog kennel and crate where the dog is, and his cot and his backpack on the floor, and no desk or anything for him to study. And it's like, well, gee, I wonder why he's struggling. There's no place for him to rest. There's the message here is, yeah, we want you here about as much as we want the dog, right? Like, you, we've sent you out with the dog. And so I think about every time that he's trying to figure out what's going on in the station. Should I be coming in for a meal? Is this the time that we do chores? Like, he's relegated to the porch, basically. And so the message here is not very inclusive. It doesn't say, we're glad you're here, we want to teach you, let us show you the way. And so then there's obviously this awkwardness on calls, and the messages we start telling ourselves, very consistent with, for those of you familiar with social cognitive theory, we start telling ourselves something and it affects our behavior. And then how we act starts affecting everybody else in the environment. So I'm sure how he was acting then started affecting his preceptors, going, well, now he's acting goofy. He's not confident. He's second guessing himself. Well, we can't have anybody doing this job who isn't confident and doesn't know their stuff. And then because they're acting that way, he's further telling himself, I don't know if I can do this. They don't think I know what I'm doing. Gosh, I was so confident, but now I don't have it. Those kinds of messages. So anyway, when we were successfully able to get him moved to a different environment, and it did take a couple shifts of deconditioning that to have him reach back and remember mastery experience when he was doing this well. And so that we had to go back to, okay, think back to simulation, think back to clinical experiences, think back to being at your fire department as an EMT when you were doing these things. Obviously, paramedic is at a different level, but one of the best ways to build efficacy is to remember when you've done something like this well before. And so we had to sort of brush those memories off and remind him, you can do this. We're here to help, and let's get a new environment, a fresh start, and then really see what he is able to do. And he absolutely was able to be successful. You know, he got extended a few shifts to kind of recover from what was happening there, but he was absolutely able to be successful and go on to be, you know, a great paramedic. He's had no QI issues, no problems, and his department is really happy with his skill. But those are some of the things that when you build a great home base, Dan, to your question, I think you can really help a learner understand that we want you in this profession and we believe that you can do this. Let's figure out how and build some of that resiliency.
Heather, we talk about a lot in the classroom, practice like you fight, which I think is a key for these students to be successful. But then you also illustrated, if we see a change in their behavior, or if something is going off with a student, where then could those behavior problems or those other issues be occurring? And I think that was great that someone was able to reach out to that student and say, like you said, open-ended question, what happened or what's going on? And then once we figure that out, reorienting them to the good things that they have done in the past. I think that's excellent.
Yeah, and I mentioned mastery experience, but remember first, building efficacy, also social persuasion. So when they hear positive reminders from others, and that's sort of social persuasion is what I like to call home court advantage, when you have your team cheering you on. And so finding ways to reconnect with others, this is sometimes a problem in paramedic programs when everybody goes to the field and they don't have any days when they come back and connect with others, sharing sharing those experiences and normalizing some of what's happening and that feeling. This happens in medical school too, when learners go off to clerkships and in their fourth year when they go off to do their sub-I's and they're like, am I the only one failing a shelf exam? Am I the only one struggling? And they start to feel isolated. And I think in paramedic school, this happens where they're out in their internship spots and they might be texting or they might be, you know, have a WhatsApp or whatever, but they may or may not be comfortable telling everybody, I'm feeling this way. So it is helpful to plan places in the curriculum where everybody can come back together. And so that might be National Registry Practice Days, or that might be opportunities to still have meaningful pieces of the curriculum to complete, where they are coming back on planned days and all preceptors know that's a school day, they'll be back here, you know, maybe three times during the course of that internship or however long it is, for them to come back and have, and they'll need some downtime, right? They'll need some of that time. So also it can't be so structured that they don't get what you're trying to do, which is get some of that time to normalize behavior and visit amongst themselves and say, I had this happen. I had a call and it went great, or I had a call and it was a disaster. I got chewed out. I did this and that. And for them to say, oh yeah, me too. Oh, don't feel bad. That happened to me. And sort of, and then also run some of these things by you, or to have one of their colleagues tell you to say, hey, I don't know if you heard, but this is what's going on with so-and-so. Because sometimes their friends can be the ones who can alert you that something is happening, and then you can reach out or you can approach them. So I think social persuasion is another. And then the other is vicarious experience. And so seeing others who are close to them, who resemble them either in, you know, age or appearance or experience, those kinds of things, that also helps. And then the last one we have to remember is about physiological conditions, sort of where we are in terms of health and stress and what's happening. And so if there's something going on health-wise or something going on in their family or just the environment of that station is creating a lot of stress for them, somebody you expected to do well might be struggling because basically all of their, you know, slots are taken out. I refer to working memory as slots, but all of their slots are taken up with all of these other stressors, and there's nothing left for processing what's happening on the call or a drill they might be giving at the station or what have you. And so I think as much as we can plan opportunities to help them build efficacy in any of those ways, reminders of mastery experience, promoting social and vicarious learning, those can be really helpful.
I think a couple of things you mentioned make me want to talk about different generations. Many of the educators are of different generations and backgrounds than the people they're teaching, which are common about. They're talking, they've got back channels on WhatsApp and Snapchat and all these, you know, all the social media that they are more connected than ever, yet not necessarily with us. Now, I'm a big kid inside. I love, you know, the young people in the program and find energy and, you know, don't have an issue with that. But I think there's people that do. There's people that have generational issues and think about that. How do we do that with these different generations? Because you've talked about people come in with master's degrees, people come in out of high school, and we've got the gamut, and that we do have to deal with generations that are different in our class and certainly different than ourselves.
Yeah, that's funny. I can see when, even in my doctoral students, I can see when they're on WhatsApp, you know, behind the scenes, they're smiling or they're, you know, doing something. And I'm like, well, whatever, somebody tell me what is I need to do based on, I can tell that you're having a WhatsApp conversation with somebody anonymously put in the chat what you're concerned about or what you have a question about. And then usually somebody will, they'll be like, we're wondering about this, or we're wondering where we missed X, you know? And I'm like, you know, somebody could just raise their hand and ask me. I think I'm super open. I never bite anybody's head off, and they laugh, you know, but I can totally tell when they're on a back channel, you know, conversation about something. Sometimes I think it's okay for them to have a sense too of, you know, like that sense of belonging together. But one of the ways in which I do think that we can find connection with the class is for them to have good class leadership. And I often would say this is it doesn't mean the person who is recycling. Sometimes they would like to vote the person who failed out before, and they would be like, oh, but because you know everything that's going to happen, like you have experience here. And I'm like, sometimes the person who's coming back really needs to be focused on their studies. They don't have time for a leadership position. You really need somebody in that leadership role, that class leadership role, who has a sense of sense. And what I mean is who can tell the class, no, we are not going to administration with that. That is our own problem. And we are going to solve that ourselves. We're going to go to the program director. We're going to go to leadership with something that is impacting all of us, or when we have an important request, or, you know, we're all struggling with something, we need more time here, or what have you. But these petty things, no, we are not taking that there. And who can really help, I think, the program administration understand the student experience and where things might need assistance, or a different viewpoint or what have you, and can really give you some student perspective. I think that can be really helpful. Dan, your question was like, how can we work with different generations when they're really well connected and they're finding, you know, those places where the, you know, knuckle dragging fireman who has just a high school education and is like, I was sent here by my department and I don't want to be a paramedic. And we're still pulling that person along going, but you can do it and we can help. And I think you're actually going to really enjoy this piece of your job. And if nothing else, you're going to be an amazing EMT. Even if you decide by the end that this isn't something that you want to do, you will be better at your job and you will enjoy the tools that you've added to your toolbox, because we all feel better when we can do our job better. So even those folks that have been drafted into the program and don't want to be there, they have something to add to this, you know, pot of students. And then the Navy SEAL who is retired, or the FBI agent who's in class with them, who's super high functioning, they have a perspective too, right? And they probably aren't adding, you know, they're not speaking a lot. Those are often people of few words, but they're observing a lot. And by their very quiet leadership, they're adding something to the mix. They tend to, you know, have lived a whole career already, and they can help kind of silently guide some, you know, more immature behaviors from the others. So creating spaces and environment for the class to have those meetings, class meetings, conversations, to plan social activities and encouraging that, even things like in the having a kitchen or a place for them to have toast and coffee and simple snacks, so that they will congregate together and have conversations that don't involve you, and but a channel, a regular once a week meeting with the program faculty or the, you know, program leadership, so that they can kind of tell you, hey, we're concerned about so and so. Hey, a few people are struggling, or so and so got kicked out of his apartment and he's living in his car, so that you can get your ear to some things that might impact performance or belonging or something that's going on, and that where you have resources in your program or in your school, you can get those resources in front of the student who needs them. Those are ways I think that we can work with different generations in a way that doesn't make us have to differentiate our program, our education, and even our skill set for every single learner, but can capitalize on what the students are already doing in a fabulous way. They have a different ability to be chameleons, I think, than some of us do.
Heather, you said you have all different types of people coming into the programs at UCLA, and I think I heard you say 42 students in, 42 students out. So, I think I know the answer to it, but I want others to hear the answer to it. So are you saying that you expect to have 100% pass rate with these students, passing just the class part or the registry part? Or can you talk a little bit about that? And how do you do that with those different types of learners?
I think it has to be the goal, 42 in, 42 out. And so that had been one of our mottos always. So it starts with, don't accept people into the program who you don't think can be successful. And so obviously there has to be some process on the way in to make sure that you have enough applicants, that you are only accepting people in who've demonstrated that they're ready. And so if that means that this time you are only taking 38, because that's how many you have ready, we have the fortunate experience that we rarely had a smaller class. I would love to have 36 or 32 or go back to the days of, smaller classes. That is not happening. But the idea is that you ensure that you have some sort of feeder program or our readiness program. And so one of the ways we did that was a paramedic prep program so that learners could see in a less condensed situation. Paramedic prep for us was over 8 days, but spread out over a month. So they only were coming to class 2 days a week, but still on that, because the program here in Los Angeles, almost all the programs are accelerated, meaning they go to class 8 hours a day. And that's just because of our audience here is a fire-based EMS audience who the backfill is what's most expensive about going to paramedic school. Never would I recommend that in terms of is that the best learning model ever? We all know that spaced repetition and opportunities for practice and, interleaving are probably better learning models, but that's not the fire department's situation. And so you adjust, right? And so because that's our situation, that they need to get in and out as quickly as possible, they're in class 8 hours a day, close to 40 hours a week. And so we want to model that, but in prep, we decompress the schedule a little bit so that they're only in class 2 days a week, but sitting for 8 hours. Many learners have not sat for 8 hours in years because they chose the fire service or ambulance service to be active. They said, I do not want to sit at a desk. I want to do an active job. So just the act of sitting you have to train yourself for, is hard. Staying awake for 8 hours, very difficult, those ideas. And then the content was chosen specifically, mostly anatomy, physiology, content like cardiology, how to read an EKG. We purposely chose topics that tend to give people trouble in paramedic school, so that they would have a first pass at that content. And so that when they see it again in paramedic school and it counts, if you will, then it's really the second time they're seeing that content. And also so that some of the departments could use prep as a way to signal whether their members were ready for the rigors of paramedic school. They also were doing quizzing. So I'm in class for 8 hours. I have this much content, morning content, afternoon content. And the next time I come, there'll be a quiz on that material. So I can also see what it takes to get ready. Now, when they come to paramedic school, it's going to all speed up. But that readiness program could signal to both them and their department, am I ready? MedMath is one of the places that one of the content areas that was included, and it's one of the places where some learners struggle. So I used to say, this is the time to find the eighth grader on the corner on your block who's doing math and hook up with them, because this is exactly what they're doing. Like whatever they're learning in class, or if they have a tutor, connect with them, because that's the person that that's the level of math that we're talking about. But these are the times to get help before you get in the program, and it's moving at this incredible pace. And so it could really help signal to people, is now the right time, or should I not come in September? I should wait until the January program, or should I wait until, the spring program? So helping people make the right choice. I often will say there's a right place for everyone. There's a right place and a right time. Is now the time for you to be successful? And so making people feel like they're wanted and included, but we just want to make sure that they're set up for this to be the right time for them. So prep is one of those ways in which you can make sure that people are ready, ready to come a readiness program.
Okay. Now let's go back to instructors for a second, because what I see when I listen to you, what I hear is I hear someone that has a certain maturity and trust in the process. What happens to the educators, or what do we say to the educators who say, all right, Heather's letting the inmates run the asylum here. right? That all of a sudden that we are giving all this power to the students, you know, I prefer to have a little bit more control. I'm driving this. I'm not, you're like talking about more about support. Others look at more of an academy philosophy, more of a driving philosophy, more of a sage on the stage philosophy and doing that. So in that, I see you back there. So in that, we have to say hi to Ricky. Ricky Battle, paramedic of the year, 2023. It's very good to see you.
Good to see you, sir. I apologize. He usually has the thing up.
No, you're totally good. What do you say to the educator that is the sage on the stage, that's the authoritarian? And how do we blend this in to still create that environment, or do we? What, I'm sure you've had instructors like that in your experience in your classes.
Sure. And also, there are many folks that run an academy, style or run at the academy and feel like they need to be more like that. There's maybe nothing wrong with that. If in that style, the message is coming across that we want you here. The problem is when it is about the instructor, then when we think about the messages that learners are getting, if I'm the most important person in this equation as the instructor, then I feel like that comes across. Like when I think about learners when I'm thinking about when I'm teaching, I often would think, I already know this material. I have taught this material literally dozens of times, if not hundreds of times. I'm not up here for my health. Like I already know it. I'm already a card carrying member of the club. I have a paramedic license. So it's not for me. It is for you. So don't sit there like a bump on the log. If you are not understanding something that we're doing right now or talking about right now, I need somebody to get their hand in the air and be like, can you go back? I am not getting that. But, this requires an incredible amount of self-regulation on our part as instructors to go, it ain't about you, folks. It is about the learner. This is why you get up in the morning, is to make sure that those folks, the faces in front of you, those little faces are a reflection on how well you do your job. And so if those 30 people or 42 people don't leave there every hour, whether you have 2-hour classes, 4-hour classes, or 8-hour classes, if they don't leave there understanding what you were trying to put down, if they're not picking up what you were putting down today, you did not do your job. So if you get your sense of self-esteem from teaching, if you're the sage on the stage, then it is absolutely our responsibility, your responsibility, to make sure you communicate it in a way that the 18-year-old, the 22-year-old, and the 50-year-old picked it up and can use it. That's the most important piece, because who cares if they know it tomorrow morning on the quiz or Friday on the quiz or a month from now on a block exam? What I care about is when the tones go off and they need that information on a call, that they can apply it to a patient. And so that's actually why I got a doctorate in education. When Ricky was in school, he was falling asleep every night with the book on his chest. I'd come out at 4 o'clock in the morning when it was time to wake him up to drive back down to paramedic school, because we lived pretty far away at the time. He was unconscious on the living room floor, book on his chest. He's totally asleep, knew nothing. And I was like, there has to be a better way. He was falling asleep driving home, had run up on the curb, almost hit a fire hydrant. How ironic would that have been? One time he fell asleep with the kids in the car. They thought it was hilarious because he went up on the curb and they were like, "Woo, this is fun." The kids were really little at the time. And I was like, this is ruining our life. Why is it so hard for people to learn how to be paramedics? We can do better. And so I became very interested in the science of learning. How do we learn and remember things a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And that's how I ended up at USC getting a doctorate in education, is because I wanted to learn how to communicate with people and find different strategies and techniques for people to learn things once and for all and forever, but also be open to the idea that information changes and I have to be able to change with it. And so there's lots of literature that says when we as educators share what our path has been. So if you want to be the sage on the stage, here's how do you do that. If it's all about you still, share with people what your path has been. Share with them how you learned this material. Share with them the things that were tough for you, but then how you got it. Because there's plenty of literature that says when teachers, when people in positions of authority, particularly instructors, share their methods, share their story, share with them, you know, the road traveled, learners feel more connected to the instructor. They feel more connected to the class. They feel like they're part of something, and it builds their persistence by about 20%. And think about your class. Did you lose one, two, five learners out of your last class? What would 20% add back? And how could we maybe keep a couple of those people that were like, I don't think I can do it. I'm not sure how to do it. But when you share with people what your path has been, when you talk to them about how you did it, what was hard for you, how you overcame that. Sometimes I would tell people, you know, it's not a great idea to give lidocaine to third degree heart block. It'll really take out all of this.
Does confidence come into play for the educator in this to be able to let go and do this? What are the attributes of an educator you'd want to do this in a classroom?
Yes, I would guess that comes into play. Like, this is a cute story. I was watching, this was way back when I was at County Fire, and I was watching somebody do a PHTLS lesson, and they got to the slide that was like FIC principle. And they're like, FIC principle, everybody remembers this, right? Click. And they went to the next slide, and I was like, whoa, back that up. Does everybody remember FIC principle? And my thought was, he doesn't remember FIC principle, and he doesn't want to cover it because he doesn't want anybody to ask any questions about it. And so I, you know, was like, hey, let's just review this really quickly. But so probably that does come into play, right? You don't want to leave too much room for people to ask questions or get you off track if you're not sure about the material yourself. But then, you know what? There's so many resources now. If you're not sure about something, that turn that into an activity where we stop and look something up. I do think that we have changed in our industry from you must have everything memorized to you need to be familiar with. And one of the classes said that I should just put that on a shirt, you need to be familiar with. You need to be familiar enough with something to be able to find it quickly. So I don't think you can look everything up, but information is coming at us really quickly these days. And so I do think that in terms of culture of safety and patient safety, it is better to ask and verify with your partner, with medical control, with others, than to guess. Please don't guess, especially when we're talking about putting a tube in. Like, you know, don't be like, I think I got it. Really be sure and check with your partner if necessary. And so, like, when we're thinking about educators, if you're not sure about something, let's turn that into an activity. Have the students look it up. See who can find the most accurate information. See who can find the information the quickest. And then you don't have to be the only source of information anymore. Building those research skills, building those information seeking and gathering skills is also a really important element of their, you know, development. And so in terms of your confidence in having to know everything 100%, it's okay to say, this isn't something that I learned. Here's what I know about it. Here's how we can learn together. Oftentimes I will say there is more expertise seated in front of me than there is standing in front of you. Here's what I know. And then let's build on that together and ask for input from the group. Level of humility, I think, can go a long way when we're exploring something new together.
Humility, I like it. Chuck, I think it's time for a wind down. Do you have a last question or a last word?
I think the last word I have is, I agree with what you're saying, Heather, but sometimes I will hear people say, change is hard, or I've been doing it this way for so many years, I don't think I can take that step, or I can't let go of the reins for the students, for another instructor. What advice would you give those instructors?
Well, change is hard, but only as hard as you make it, right? What are the sayings? People, the only people that like change are, you know, babies with a wet diaper and, you know, but it's only as hard as you make it, and you can make it exciting. And I think the folks that worked with and for me at UCLA sometimes would be like, can you just leave things alone for one class? Can you just let things be the same for one class? And one of the things I think is, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. Like, it is our responsibility to keep iterating. If you have a mindset of CQI, of continuous quality improvement, Kaizen is this improvement in small increments, right? Is continuing to just get a little bit better at something. That helps, that mindset of like, we're continuing to iterate. So that can help. We're not talking about overhauls. Overhauls can seem overwhelming. We think about how change happens a little bit at a time, can seem much more manageable. How do you eat that elephant a little bit at a time? And then also, there's incredible resources. Look at yourselves, you know, either one of you, myself, the other, you know, wonderful people who've been doing this for a long time would be happy to help anybody who's like, okay, I want to try that. How do I do it? Let's get on the phone. Let's do it together. Let's get on Zoom. Like, any of us would be like, let's chart that path.
Absolutely.
And work together on the next steps.
A key thing you just said there, Heather, is I think being afraid not to fail and try something new as an educator versus I'm going to stay with what I've done all along. And then I know that this might work, but I really can't take a chance, or I don't want to take a chance. I like that philosophy there for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think both of you are great examples of being willing to try something different. I don't know how many times I've heard Dan say, let's give it a try. If it doesn't work, we'll try the next thing, or we'll go back to what did work. But how are we going to know if we don't continue to iterate, especially where there's good evidence for success? I mean, I can, you know, point you in 100 directions of small research studies that are demonstrating this is successful. And we can look outside of EMS. Like, there's so many others in STEM courses, in nursing, in other courses that have demonstrated this works, this is successful, here's how you do that. And so we can also learn from other education programs beyond our own.
When someone says, hey, we'll try that, that's still one step short of hold my beer, right? It doesn't have to be crazy or reckless. The fact is, it does a little bit of spirit, a little bit of going out there. I think if someone listens to this and says, you know, as my classes change, as my people change, as I change, as I want to recruit and retain students, as I want to make great providers and make them feel important, it can even be little steps that are going to get you there. And then you'll get the feedback, hopefully, from the students that will make that path seem like it's right.
I love that, Dan.
Absolutely. Well, maybe since I got an I love that, we'll call it a day. We try and keep it to about 40, 45 minutes. And we could go on for hours. So on behalf of Chuck and I and all the people that are listening, I really think people will listen to this and look at their classrooms a little bit differently. That 42 in, 42 out concept is something that I'll use in my next class. Take that number and look at that attitude. And I just thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you both.
Thanks, Heather.
Bye-bye.